Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody.
Brian Brushwood.
Ahoy.
Gentlemen, let's begin with the questions. We love it when you have questions, not because we're lazy and it means we don't have to prepare anything. we love follow-up. We love when people say, hey, you gave me some advice before and it helped a lot. You guys have value. Stop crying yourself to sleep at night. It's okay. I mean, something like that. This is from David, David Potts. He says, hey, guys, long time, third time. You know the advice everyone gives about the importance of starting a mailing list for your product brand, even if you don't send emails initially? Well, I did that. Been slowly collecting email addresses over the last couple of years, up to about 2,000 now, but I haven't sent a single thing yet. So my question is, can you give any general advice on starting to make use of an existing email list for my product? Is it something I shouldn't race into unless I'm ready to be disciplined and consistent with it? Also, I have a lot of email addresses, around 500, via people who have tipped me via PayPal. Is it okay to add these to my mailing list, or is that rotten? Likewise with the emails from my Patreon supporters, around 300. Thanks for all you do, David Potts. He writes, P.S., I first wrote back in 2017 asking about focusing my YouTube guitar lessons on pop songs versus songs I love. I had 17,000 subscribers back then, and then happy to say I just passed 100,000. Been going great. Thanks to your continued After Things advice.
Dude, congratulations. That's fantastic, man. I think in general it's better to do literally anything than not do something. Just on the whole, like the moment I catch myself coming up with a capital RGE, really good excuse for why the correct answer is to not do anything, then like that's a giant red flag, and I almost certainly turn out to be wrong in that advice. You know, there certainly are exceptions, but in the meantime, like if you're worried that you don't know what to say, think of it as it's a microphone right there and you don't know what to say. Put yourself in a position where you have to say something, stand up on that stage, get in that spotlight, and then figure out what comes out and give yourself permission to be bad and then know that you're going to get better.
Well, let me focus it a little bit more though, because Brian, I think you've done a great job, probably even more so than I know myself, and I think Andrew's mailing list has very often been product focused, you know, in the past. But Brian, your method of mail of the mailing list is very conversational, and oftentimes I think you even find little things that you can send out that don't always say, like, all right, and now buy this. Much of it is now buy this, but even then, there is a veneer of, hey, so this is what I did, and this is what's going on, and isn't this cool? I found this link. Also, here are these things. But if you could talk a little bit about how you came to that rationale.
Yeah, and I'm not going to say I'm 100% right on this one, but here's what I know, is that much like the YouTube algorithm picks winners and losers, Gmail and all of your email providers picks winners and losers. And part of the way it figures out whether or not something is spam or whether or not it's a real email, part of it is clues like, was it sent by, you know, a multi-mail service? But the other thing they look at is the open rate. So just like somebody could subscribe to you and the YouTube algorithm can figure out over time that in general, they're not clicking on your new videos and then slowly take you out of their recommended feed. Same thing happens with email. So it's really important that if you want to maintain that consistent open rate, that people in general, number one, don't take it personally if somebody doesn't open your emails and doesn't engage on it. That's just not a right fit for whatever it is. And there are different schools of thought. For example, Touch of Modern is a commercial enterprise that will email people on the list like five times a day. And their thinking is, if you're not here to buy stuff, then we need to know that real fast. And so we're gonna be hitting you, because we're here for people who want to buy stuff. And if you don't belong on this list, why don't you hit that unsubscribe button and hit the bricks? Because they're not interested in feeling good about having big numbers. They're interested in moving product. And if you're not there for Touch of Modern doing their Touch of Modern thing, then get bent. I could probably benefit from more of that attitude and take the, if you're here for Brian, then you're going to get a whole bunch of Brian. And that means, number one, sometimes it's content. Sometimes it really is just a story from the road or an exciting thing. Or I have a new show that you're probably interested in. Here's a behind the scenes thing. Sometimes I'll just go to Reddit and type in dad jokes, and then I'll just send a dad joke with maybe a PS new product launch today. But some of them are very, very short. Some of them are very, very long and detailed. But my hope is that, you know, the reason that we love slot machines is because we crave random reinforcements. Sometimes, you know, you never know. Sometimes it'll be an ad. Sometimes it'll be a think piece. Sometimes it'll be a behind the scenes. Sometimes it'll be a jump the line, super secret thing. But I will say, oh, go ahead.
Yeah. See, you know, I think the strategy is like, you know, one is if you have a lot of products and new products all the time, you know, like I get, you know, you get emails probably from Amazon every day because Amazon has every product in the world. So you're not like, Amazon's trying to sell me stuff again. It's like, well, I buy stuff every day. Sometimes that stuff is on Amazon. So I don't read a lot of them, but I know, oh, this is helpful. Now, if I'm getting an email from somebody who has only one product to sell, you know, like one literally like not, I mean, literally like, you know, if I only had one book to sell and I sent you an email every week trying to get you to buy that book, I would drive people crazy.
Which now you can pull that off if you are sending me a new thoughtful essay every single week.
Yes, Brian. That's yeah. If I'm contacting you and telling you something other than buy my book. Then you're, something new from Andrew, and it's not just Andrew saying, buy my book. And that's the thing, is you have to say, but if you don't want to do the thoughtful essay or do that stuff, that's a lot of work. And I'd say, then it's fine every few months. Hey, I got a book. That's my approach, is like, I don't write these thoughtful little comments. And every now and then, if I have something useful, like, I did some cool talks about writing, I'll send a thing out there. But generally, when people hear from me, it's when, hey, I have a new book out, because generally it's why people wanted to get on my list, because they want to know when I have a new book out.
By the way, here's a fun hack. If you have just the one book, then what you could do is write a bunch of emails, each one a thoughtful essay. Guess what happens after a week of doing those? You got a little thing called you've written a second book now. And so now, you know, you call that out. They become chapters. You smooth it all over. And now you have another set of your thoughts arranged, you know, categorically.
Sure. I think that for many of us, that's a lot more work than, you know, you have an email brain. I have a novel brain. I can sit down and write a novel, and I'm not intimidated. You have an email brain. So for you to sit down and say, well, this is how I do this. This is how I write it. It comes easy for people who, and I started doing a lot of regular emails. Then I just faded. Cause I'm like, you know,
well, but now you send out links.
That is the one muscle. And man, I'll tell you what, when you work with Andrew Main, very often you find that there are elements that you thought that you were good at that Andrew is much better and as a dedication. But the one thing I knew I could always do that Andrew was always very impressed with is my ability to write a thing every day. That at some point Andrew will eventually be like, ah, man, another one of these, huh? Jeez. Yeah, I'm going to how about I don't? I'm going to stop doing this.
Yep.
Yeah, the other thing is you mentioned that there were two lists. I think anyone who's given you money, what you do is you just make a second list called VIPs. These are a very special group of people.
I think his larger question was, is it kosher to take the emails of people that have tipped him via PayPal? And is it kosher to take his Patreon supporters and put them on an email list? What are the ethics of that for your guys' perspective?
Per the Can Spam Act of however long ago in the United States, if you have any transactional business with someone, then you don't need permission to put them on a list and contact them if it is about the thing that they gave money. So in this case, if they gave you money for your tutorials, then they are somebody you have a business relationship with in the tutorials. The thinking being anybody who has bought, you know, let's say my book test, certainly I should be able to reach out to those people and say, hey, we found an error on page 75. You should know about this. That's transactional business. And so what you're describing sounds like it would fall underneath that. Now, whether or not it's tacky or not, that's your question that you have to evaluate your relationship with your audience. For example, when Cord Killers left the old network and became an independent show, there was like the last thing we said on the old network is we don't know what's next, but if you want to be along for that ride, sign up on this email. And it's like overnight, there was 5,000 names on this one email. And that is a very special list in that every time I send something to it, 80% of it opens. And as a result, I think I've only pressed the button 3 or 4 times, and they've been about important Cord Killers related stuff. The exception being, like, I called up Tom and I said, hey, this is our shared audience. It's the Cord Killers audience. I have a TV show coming out. Is this, you know, are we both able to turn the key and feel good about reaching out to this highly engaged special list? But and that was, I think that's the only time we did that. I think we did an announcement for Patreon, an announcement for the independent show and all that stuff. So in that regard, I think it is good to kind of have different voices for different subgroups. And I think it would be good to have a VIP list, and you could just open in line. I found that people really appreciate you flatly saying why this is, you know, you are receiving this because you're on a very special list of 800 people who have ever given me money. Now they know. Now they know. And then, you know, next line is like, you know, if you don't want this, no harm, no foul if you hit that unsubscribe. Now they're even more interested in what you have. If anything, that's going to create more excitement for whatever wisdom you're about to drop. And so we're a big fan of breaking out individual lists based on certain products, or it's important to know kind of what the value of individual people are, and to say you are on this list of this many people for this reason. I'm talking to you about this one very important time sensitive, either product release or opportunity or whatever. I think all of that is a really, really good idea, and you can have different voices.
You know, and don't be afraid. I mean, yeah, you can, as far as we understand, you can put those people on a mailing list. Just if you just want to put them in your group, in your big list, have an easy to find unsubscribe button. You know, I have found that people, for every person that says, get me off this list, or I don't want to be on this list, who can't find the unsubscribe button, I'll get 10 or 20 people who are like, oh, cool, something new. I didn't, you know, or how do I find out more? You know, it's natural. And there are people whose stuff I like, but I start going, I'm not into their thing right now, and I'll unsubscribe, and nothing personal against them. And I don't take it personally against me when I, you know, when I get that, I'll get some, you know, I've had like once or twice, I'm like, how did I get on this list? I never signed up my name for this list. And I see where they went into and did like my MailChimp, clicked in, put their email address in there, and they got a confirmation email. You're like, you're just angry at somebody today. That's fine. And I've had that like once or twice. But, you know, make the unsubscribe very easy. And as long as you've had that transaction with them, so email them. And then, you know, in magic, we get people who are just drive us up the wall with stuff. And, you know, and also like, I don't know, like I would do's and don'ts, like, don't send an email, the subject line, I have a special gift for you, and it's a 20% off coupon.
things like that. You can take advantage of the curiosity gap, but you better pay it off, because otherwise they're going to sniff it out, and then they won't, maybe they'll open that one, but they won't keep on opening when they come on in.
Yeah, and their trust went down, and you can tell, like, you can kind of tell, like, in, you know, some of these emails you get like, mortgage is due, you know, the way some of these things, and it's understandable, you know, but it's the way some of these things are worded, the desperation that comes through for that. But I think, you know, don't be afraid to just say, hey, general update, I have these things available, blah, 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 put together, send this email out. If you want to get off, just click unsubscribe here. Just do a thing here. Just remind people I've got this thing here, my Patreon, whatever. Tell them something's coming up, you know, do that. Don't be afraid to do it, but don't feel like it's a blog or something you have to keep at it every, you know, consistently. There are people that when I see it come up, you know, and it's okay when you have a release coming to say, hey, something's going to be coming out. Something's out today and something just came out, you know, to do a couple, like 3 emails to sort of hit people with what's going on.
That is a really good point, because as you're email list matures, at first you're going to see like 80% open rates. It's going to be insane. And then it will mature and it will level out closer to, you know, 25% is fantastic if you could get there. But even if it gets down to 15%, all that means is that you have to figure out ways to iterate the message. The message is announcing this thing that's going to happen. And then it's like, heads up, 3 days till this thing happens. Today's the day the thing is happening. And then a follow-up of like, oh my God, the thing happened yesterday. If you missed it, it's not too late. And now, because it won't be the same 15% every time, and it's tempting to perceive it that way, but there is going to be that 15%, if you hit them four times with four relevant messages that are all relevant to their interests, now you're reaching a good 30 to 40% of your audience.
Can I share a little, how I say it's a trick, but a thing to think about, and often I don't see this really understood or exploited as much. And one of the things that's really misunderstood about email marketing, we talk about open rates, and open rates are very, very helpful, you know, for understanding how many people read your open rate. But one of the ways that I use email is I think of the subject line as a mini Twitter post.
Correct.
Because I know so many emails don't get opened, but I know that people see it, and if they see that subject line, if I just say, hey, some cool news for you, I've wasted it. That's why if you read my subject lines, you'll see new Theo Kray book, you know, book out today or this. So people go, Andrew Main, new book. They know that. And then maybe they'll open, but at least I've got that. Treat that subject line is advertising. So even if you're, you know, 25% open rate's fantastic, you know, but I guarantee you the number of people who see your email, if it's not bounced, is closer to, you know, 80% or so.
And by the way, that's popping up on people's phones. That's popping up on their watches. It's popping up anywhere that a push alert for an email will go. And if that's the only thing that's ever seen, you got to make that count.
Right. So Bryce just put a thing that said you use like curiosity subject lines. Maybe, but I think they're kind of BS, and I think people know that. And I think that if you look at four, you've got to deliver on that. And I think that a curiosity line, I think if you're like Brian and you got a really good relationship and something's going to be delivered, I think that the problem with, oh my God, you won't believe what I just saw. The internet is filled with that now. We're so numb to this. When you see this, you'll gasp, you know, and. Yeah.
You know, I think, Brian, the email that you sent out when All's Well was climbing was an example of a curiosity gap thing where, like, I think the headline was, I need to borrow $2 or something
like
that. Yeah,
I need $2 and I need it in the next 4 hours. Like, it was very specific but that's relevant.
Yeah, and I would say that it's a good example of a good one because you told me there's going to be a transaction. You told me right there. Brian's asking me for $2, you know, and so.
Well, and then also, but it was like paid off. It wasn't
exactly.
like I need $2.
It was
a down payment for the $20 thing that is now available. It's like, no, we need this amount right now. Look at what the traction we're getting. If you want to be a part of this moment that's happening right now, you got to get in. So it's like that is. Piqued your curiosity, but then paid it off. The thing in the email was more exciting than the curiosity line, which is a good way to think about it.
Hey,
but
curiosity line was, it was some sort of sales pitch or something. So I'm okay with this. Yeah. I'm not like, oh, I've got a secret to share with you. Like, you know,
it's a product.
So the exact headline was, "Hoo boy, I need $2 right this minute. It's super important, and I swear it'll be worth it." And then the headline after that says, "Look, man, I don't know how this happened, but we got 4 hours to turn something into truly magical. You got $2?" And then we insert a tweet and saying, "This is where we're at on the charts. Here's what we know about the way these charts work. They roll in, you know, 4 hour increments, so it does matter when you do it. Here's why we're doing it. We're celebrating Stephen Cogswell. We priced it intentionally as low as we can. Here's a sample from the album. We're really, really proud of it, you know, and you know, your decision gate. Like if you want to be a part of this, then it's really a blast." So this one, let me take a look at the opening rate. Yeah, here we go. So out of 120,000 emails, it got 15,000 opens, which is 12.2%. It got a little over 1% click. So 1,300 plus clicks. It's hard to know how many. I didn't do any revenue things to track because it wasn't in my store. So I don't know how many clicks it generated, but again, certainly everybody who passed over it, you know, they got the message. They know there's an album, there's a thing. And that's something that provides, even if nobody buys it or not many people bought it because of the email, at the very least, they got the other message, which is guess who is about to hit number one on comedy? Brian Brushwood has a comedy album.
Yeah, 100%. But I've always very much appreciated your style of writing for the emails, and I think that it's probably, I mean, definitely among the three of us, that's the one that really, I mean, because your email marketing list churns the really stirs the drink when it comes to the store, right? Is that safe to say?
Oh yeah, no, it's in fact it's strong enough now that it's changed the way we just until we can grow the store, we kind of have to just lean on the email, because otherwise we'll get too many things sold. Like we're getting ready to do mystery boxes, and I don't think we're even going to make a video out of it, because I'm pretty sure this will be what, our third year doing mystery boxes, and people have dug them enough that last year for the first time I said, hey, tomorrow we're doing mystery boxes. You bought one last year, so you're getting this super secret email. You could jump the line, and as always, you don't even know what you're buying, but you know that it's satisfaction guaranteed. And based on how pleased they were last time, it was like the day of the launch, we kind of had to soft launch it because we'd already sold most of them. And that's because we had provided consistent value, and they knew what they were getting in terms of quality of response and stuff. But yes, I would say that email has become such a powerful tool that I've had to slow down the shouting about it on other platforms because stuff is already sold out.
And to David's credit, if he's concerned, you know, there's something, I don't know if we've talked about it on this show, but the idea of depositing and withdrawing from your customers,
yeah,
in terms of what you're giving and what you're taking from them. You know, in David's case, and I think it matches ours, and I don't even know if we do it quite as much, but David's, it seems like a lot of what David's business is making videos, giving instructions. He's got a nice website that sends people, you know, more detail. He has a Patreon. But he is building this thing around a content machine, right? Making these videos. And so, you know, I would say, you know, if there's a moment where you feel like, oh, am I asking too much of people? Well, you are making content as a primary, I don't know, a primary motivator, which could be a subject of an email that is not asking for something. You can say, hey, we have a new thing out. Have you seen this? And it's just, this is the thing I know you like. You liked me because of this thing. Here's the new one. Just check in and make sure you know it. And then suddenly it's not everything is marketing. Not everything is asking something of the email, or it's not asking for direct money, right? You're, you know, getting people to look at a video is different.
And there's nothing wrong with it being a business relationship. That don't feel bad. I'm selling them something. Yeah. You know, I subscribe to some emails because I want them to sell me stuff. I want Brian to sell me stuff. I've got my puzzle box here. I pay full price, everybody. I'll have you know that. Because I like this stuff. I think this stuff is cool. There are some people that like, you know, like I'm a big Matthew Reinhardt pop-up book fan, which, you know, maybe if he does an email list, I don't know. But like, man, like he doesn't need to email me. If I could just auto buy everything he puts out, I would do it, you know, because this guy's output will never exceed my willingness to buy.
So speaking of which, that is a bit of advice that I don't think we've given before. If you want to learn to write good emails, sign up for a lot of people's email lists. And I know that's so counterintuitive. None of us think, I want to sign up for spam. We're all very reluctant to sign up for stuff. So instead, be the reverse. Sign up. Think of all the people you like as a consumer. Sign up for their email list, a lot of them, and then figure out which ones you naturally tend to immediately open. And as you read, like, oh, wait, I just realized if it's longer than this long, I only glance at the first couple of paragraphs and then stop. So what a shame if you're getting ready to announce a product and you don't get it in that first couple of paragraphs when your own behavior is not going with it. So pay attention to your own reaction to other people's writings. You're going to pick up tricks from their writing that will happen organically, where you're going to be like, oh my God, I have to read this. And you're like, wait, how did that happen? What did they say that caused that reaction in me?
Yep. Absolutely. And you know, that's, we learned a lot, like reading other people's like magic marketing emails and stuff. And then you could see a lot. You can like what's effective and then what's not. And then it kind of, you know, comes down to, it's like, tell me what's out there, you know? And then,
and look, I think that there is a difference, as Brian said, with like Touch of Modern, that they are, and many of these email lists, people, it is people's jobs to like basically target you as a possible amount of money, find you, and then hit you with as many things as they need to get the money out of you. And that's fine. Like, if you are running a site like that, then that is a way to do it. And some people, like, as we were talking about in Magic, they certainly seem to have that philosophy. I don't know what their bottom line is. I don't know what money they got coming in, but that certainly seems to be their philosophy on how to do it. For entertainment stuff, and Brian's kind of, I think, riding the line of like, all right, this started as an email list about, hey, book me for your college. Hey, I'm coming into your town. Hey, I've got these cool things coming up. And then it kind of morphed into a product thing that then continued to be refreshed by people that were buying things on the site. So it's like, it's a bit of a hybrid in between of like, hey, I want to be respectful of your time, but cool thing, you are interested in me? Just so you know, I'm doing this thing. Check it out. And I think it's like understanding your motivation for it and what you want your relationship to be is fairly important.
Yeah, and keep in mind, as you're looking at other people's emails that come in, we've talked about this a little bit more recently because it came up, but sometimes it's very hard to figure out what you like about a thing and why you like it. It's very easy to figure out what you hate and why you hate it. So if you can't begin with a core that, you know, of what you want to model about these, then just begin by saying, okay, this dude, too often, not relevant, not funny, and always hammering on buying his crap. And it's like, great, those are great vectors that you now get to draw borders around, and you get closer to seeing what your email content should look like.
Let me ask you a question, Brian. How often, in looking at emails, it doesn't look like, and you use the whole, hey, Andrew, as much, or the insert the person's name there?
I have, and usually I'll throw that, like, if I can't think of a good A-B test to do, that's usually the distinction I'll do, just for a loose curiosity of whether or not it makes a difference. And it really doesn't seem to make much of a difference, maybe a percentage point.
Yeah, I always thought it was, I was always a little put off by, like, people I don't have a relationship or this or whatever, and I'm like, I know you just had an insert my name here, but you will respond to people, and that's sort of what's different, is that if I respond to you, somebody from there will talk to me or whatever.
So remember we talked about the importance of training the algorithms to perceive your emails as actual correspondences. Every so often, you got to do a 6-word email and just ask a question. And then I sent like a 2-line thing saying, hey guys, it's Brian. We're getting ready for the big holiday season. What are you most excited about? I'd love to hear from you. And then 3,500 responses later. And it was a full 2 or 3 days. I spent individually responding to every single one of them, because that is making a deposit in the emotional bank account. That is saying, hey, it really is me on the other side of this, and you really are having a dialogue. That was extraordinarily valuable, partly because it was good intel. Like I was like, oh wow, it sounds like this year we're going to move a lot more of this kind of thing in that vague kind of intuitive sense that looking at a lot of data gives you. But also, I think that's super important to building up that likelihood that they'll open that email again. And you got to remember that the email is its own performance. It's its own destination. It's its own form of art. And it is an art. It is your creative energy. It is a virtual version of yourself that you're putting out to the universe, just like your YouTube videos.
And it's a very, very good point about, you know, taking the time to respond. When I send something out, like, I like to do kind of short text-based emails, or if I'm going to send a photo email and I like to promote a book, I'll put my face in it, because I want people to be like, oh yeah, this guy, Andrew, okay, whatever, it's him. But when I get responses, I respond. And people are totally cool with me writing, cool, thank you, cool, awesome, great, whatever, you know, Andrew, whatever. When people get that, most time they never expect a response. They see that and they go, wow, Andrew read my email. And unless it's like a long question, a lot of times, oh, I'm excited. I'm like, hey, thank you, whatever. Makes people feel better.
Man, I remember, God, this had to be forever ago, but there was somebody that I remember talking to you, Andrew, that we were, it was a podcast we both listened to, but you had sent an email in to them, and I don't think it was on a mailing list, but it was just an email in either like mentioning something that had been on the podcast, and you just got a response that was literally just THX. Like it was just like a shortened version of thanks, but it's like, that was cool. Like,
yeah, it's cool.
About it the next day, we're like, wow, that's cool. Yes, it's literally the minimum amount of effort that you would need to do to send it back. But it was well received. It was it was like well met. It was awesome.
And that's the thing is there's an astonishing asymmetry between the amount of time that it takes for you and the value to your fans. I remember the time I got a courtesy one-line response from Adam Savage. I remember when I got a response from Jonathan Colton that basically was one line followed by a link. And I remember when Dan Carlin responded. And you know, some of these turned into real friendships and relationships. Others, I just remember the outsized joy I got from knowing that they read and responded to my email.
Yeah. There's a funny correlation. I remember, and I'm not going to name names, but I may have known somebody who was friends with a billionaire, and this person who I knew had pretty big following, but he would laugh because he'd get these emails from his billionaire friend, and they would be like, okay, fine, whatever. He'd be like, I got another one word email. And I'm like, yeah, the guy's a billionaire for a reason. He doesn't sit around spending an hour writing lengthy responses, you know. And that was the thing. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I've had some cool, like, I think about it now. Like, I've sent, like, you know, I write fan mails, just so you know. Like, if I read a book or something I really like from somebody, like, oh, I just loved your book. I love your things. I get, you know, I get responses and stuff, and it's cool, you know. And I kind of, you know, forgot some of the people who've done that, but that's, it's just, I do it like, hey, I just want to let you know this is great. No need to respond, blah, blah, blah. And you get a cool, like, oh, thank you so much. You know, whatever. I like to do that because I like getting them.
Yeah.
Well, and plus, you know, I started evangelizing on this earlier last year with like just the power of the unironic fan letter. It's a joy to write, and you we're talking to David, you know, with the YouTube videos, you're a person, and that little footer at the bottom that says I'm a person on YouTube, if you write 10 unironic fan letters, 3 of them are going to click and watch some of your stuff, and one of those 3 is going to respond like, holy crap, I love what you're doing, and maybe it'll turn into a business thing, maybe it won't, but I know that in fact, if we do another pick after Andrew's book, my second pick will be I think I mentioned it before, but the Under the Influence podcast by Terry O'Reilly. I sent him an unironic fan letter and got a thank you very much response. And then a year later, he had a particularly good episode. And I think I talked about it on After Things, where he talked about comic book advertisings. Advertisers having a secret conversation with children that the parents weren't able to supervise. And I was like, wow, that's so insightful. And so I wrote him a second fan letter saying that. This time, I don't know if it's because he saw the same name again or what, but this time he was like, oh, wow, I hadn't looked at your stuff before. You're a machine. You know, hey, if you ever want to talk about blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden it became an opening for a real relationship on an ongoing basis. But, man, I love writing unironic fan letters.
Yep. Groovy. Do we have time to talk about one sort of related topic?
Sure.
So I'm in the midst of going out there and promoting Murder Theory. I don't even know. I have a new book coming out called Murder Theory.
It's only and, the number one.
My strategium is this. My strategery is today I'm going to go do a Periscope stream, talk about writing, right? Because I have a nice large Twitter following. I realize that's a great place to find people. I'll go do that. I'll send out an email tomorrow like, hey, you know, Murder Theory's out. Murder Theory's here, blah, 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 blah. I've noticed that in general, in looking at my following and other people's followings and a lot of stuff, and even though you see a lot of enthusiasm, there are things that I'm into and I like, but somehow getting me to press that button is hard.
I don't understand it either, but I have the same thing. Like, I can love, love, love someone's stuff, but then it's like, and then like, even when I've said I love it and I know it's not about the money or whatever. It's just about the doing the thing that I find this weird hesitance.
You know, I contributed to a GoFundMe for somebody, I don't know, it was somebody, one of my Twitter followers or whatever, and they had kind of a sad case. And I don't normally do this because I get a lot of those, but every now and then I'll do that if I'm, and GoFundMe always is problematic because it's like, It's not like one button that presses to PayPal. And I've like, I would have given 10 times more to GoFundMe stuff if it was easier to just press that button, which shows you how bad of a human being I am. I'm like, I would help this person, but I don't want to have to spend 30 seconds entering in this. Sorry. No blankets for you, cold winter. I just think about like that. You know, Amazon is brilliant with that one button. Like, hey, let's have this one button. We have all this data saved, your shipping, everything. Just, we want you to press that because we know that fall off. And we talk about like friction. If I have to go do this step, then another step, I have a chance of losing. And sometimes that one step is a pretty high step. I know that, like, I love you guys. So if you guys are like, hey, buy our album, I'm like, okay, I'm going to go into iTunes. I'm going to go search for this and I'll buy it. Because you're my friends.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Like, I hope they remember this.
Yeah.
Take me type 3 whole minutes.
All's well with an apostrophe or not. I don't know. Here, it's good. And I think that, like, man, like that. Here, you know, the problem with doing a podcast is that, like, you know, our listeners, you know, who knows what they're doing? They're working out, you know, they're climbing mountains, you know, maybe they're in some nuclear submarine under the Antarctic ice cap. Getting somebody to go from here to action, like, yeah, we mentioned murder theory, like that, they're like, that's great, Andrew, but I'm out on my bicycle right now. You know, I'll remember it when I get home. No, we won't.
Well, but luckily you are priming them for the next time that you, when they, maybe they'll, when they get the email or when they see the tweet or whatever, that'll be the right moment. And they've already heard of it. They already remember the heuristic of, they had previously decided that they wanted to support it. And now's the right moment to do it.
Sure. Sure. And by the way, we have in the comment room, the link says your Periscope is the sole reason I bought your stuff and signed up for email. It's the personality that sells. Well, it's one person. thank you very much. It's a great way for me. Illink does like, coloring books and stuff. She's a great artist. And that's one of these, that's the beautiful thing about these relationships where you can talk to people and it goes both ways, is you discover, wow, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of the cool stuff I found is through that. Mike, you're right, Brian, but about like having like, hey, here's this, hit them a couple. That's why you want to hit them a couple of different points. You don't just want to put all your effort into one thing. You know, there was a post on Hacker News where a guy's like, something about how like, I've sold like X thousand number of books, but I've, you know, only made like $1,000 or something like this. And then you find out that he spent $15,000 on Facebook ads.
Oh my God.
And I wrote a post and I got people like, oh, you should talk more about this. I'm like, well, here's your problem. Facebook ads, $15,000. It's like, if you don't see a return on, I mean, you can use these things to launch a thing, to tell people about it. But if you're using that kind of advertising to generate sales, it just doesn't work that way.
Even the people that I've spoken with who are professionals at targeting Facebook stuff, like it's like oil reserve wildcatting. Like you are hoping to find, like, basically the money that you are getting is surveying places that may or may not, keywords, pictures, that kind of stuff that may or may not be a well for you. And then if you discover a well, which there is no guarantee, if you discover a well, then the next level is min-maxing the bidding system to get as much bang for your buck.
But yeah, you know, it's like when you're selling something that's like a $5 or $6 book, you're just not going to see the return on that. You know, if you're turning every purchase into an eventual person on the email list or something, that's one of the things you think about. Like you have to ask, like, what were your expectations? How do you think this system works? You know, but that being said, spreading it around is certainly good, but I still wonder, like, do we need better buttons?
Like, do we need a better way to go from 0 to 1? Like, if somebody's listening to it or somebody's hearing it, like something better than a link or.
Yeah, look what Amazon's done. They literally have one. They patented the one click to buy button. Now they have the Echo device, whose name I shall not pronounce lest I summon the demon. You know, which you can buy stuff through. Which I've never bought anything through because I'm just afraid of like what I'm end up buying or whatever. And also, it's just it needs to be worked out. Three, they literally have buttons. You have those buttons. You know the buttons they have, the buy buttons for like, you know.
Yeah.
You know, those things, not, I mean, the little physical hardware buttons, you know, that they've been selling.
Yeah.
Which is a clever idea, you know, but that's because they're thinking about this. How do we make them press our button when they want this? Or how do we get people to just.
Because their idea is when you get to the last roll of toilet paper, if the last thing you see in there is the roll of toilet paper and the button, and now literally that thought of, oh, I should really order more toilet paper if I'm picking up the last one, is only a button push away, like that's what they want to do. They want to find those elements where you're willing to buy, but your body or your life has not brought you to the point where you want to extend that information. Like it's not, I'm picking up the toilet paper, oh, I should really buy more stuff. I need to go get my laptop right now and log in to www.amazon.com. And then it's like you start to think of all the other places that you can buy it. Maybe I should go to the corner store. Maybe I should do that. And maybe you do. Or you just whoop, hit that button.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I do think that there are better ways that we can figure that out. And I think we're already kind of seeing it in terms of the platforms trying to take advantage of it, like Instagram's swipe up stuff. I think that there's probably better tools that Twitter could build to you know, be able to sell certain things even inside that platform. So you don't have to leave, but that would also require Twitter making a push to have your credit card on file for whatever. So yeah.
Well, you know, and it might be something we will never see Twitter do because Dorsey also runs Square, and sure. It might be, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot that can be done, but I do think that there's probably even third party things that are agnostic of platforms that would be,
yeah,
that would be great. Although that is the problem, is that all these walled gardens don't necessarily want anything to get super exciting that they don't have control over.
Yeah. All right. Fail. Picks.
Yeah. So, specifically Under the Influence podcast, it's fun. They're breezy. They all have really, really good takeaways about the nature of advertising and the great stories of all times when it comes to that. Most importantly, they recently are releasing the entire back catalog. They're calling it a digital box set. And so they have the original licensed music in there, because I think for a while they were doing the podcast version. You could tell they were always putting copyright-free versions of the music, but the digital box set version has the original music in there. I'm going through, I'm binging the whole thing. So it starts way back in, what, 2008, I think? And so it's like 10 years of podcasts that are just plowing through.
Rad, man. My pick is Netflix. Sex Education is a series on Netflix. It is British. It stars Gillian Anderson of X-Files fame as a sex therapist with a teenage son. Through various hilarious high school hijinks, he winds up giving sex advice to the high school students. But I think it's kind of very, very charming in that it's, you know, a very sort of like, it is like the 80s idea of the sex obsessed high school story. It is like its own version of like Porky's or American Pie or something like that, but in a very 2019 woke kind of thing, but not in a way that makes it cloying or preachy, in a way that very much revels in the hormone soaked realm of high school. But it's dialed up, like, you know, everybody's attractive and they look older than high school students, so you don't feel like a total creep.
I have a pick. I watched most of this over the weekend, and I'll probably watch the last bit of this before Cord Killers starts. But it's also a new Netflix series. It's Russian Doll. Did you
guys
hear about
this? Yeah, I started that this morning.
It's a Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
And it's Natasha Lyonne, who you might remember from Orange is the New Black, being stuck in, you know, this looping or.
She keeps coming back to her.
When she dies, she keeps coming back to her birthday.
Yeah, her 36th birthday. Yeah.
I have to say that. So I'm on. I'm just about to the final episode of the season. It's a show, not a movie, and I still don't even know how I feel about it just yet. I feel like I need to see what this last episode is. But it's an interesting sort of take on this. She ends up meeting a guy who's going through the exact same thing, and then they're working together to try to figure stuff out. But I this is something where the ending I think is going to play a large part into how much I like it. But it's pretty nice. You said you started watching it, Brian?
Yep. I just got to the end of the second episode, I think. But early enough that I didn't even know there was another person who was having the same experience.
I feel okay mentioning it because they put him in the trailers.
Okay.
Stuff.
Okay. But casting, she's fantastic.
She's great.
I'll save anything other details. Okay. They do. I'm with you. Like, part of me is kind of sad that it's such a popular trope these days, and it's taking away the specialness of it. I feel like, you know? And
I wish it were recognized as it should be, as a genre. It is a genre of storytelling, and I think that it can be done a million different ways. That we should be looking at it. It should be categorized as.
Groundhog Day movies.
I think it is. I mean, there's, you know, you went from Groundhog Day. There were some other indies and sort of did stuff like that. Then you had Happy Death Day
and Edge of Tomorrow.
And I don't know. With Happy Death Day, especially, I always think it's weird when these like modern day movies have to try to exist in a world where Groundhog Day doesn't exist.
Yeah, they sort of dance around it.
Except Happy Death Day does exist in that universe, but the main character doesn't know about the movie, and he's just a big idiot. Like the end punchline of the anyway. But I think Russian Doll has the way that it's pointing at the end of the season makes it seem like there are weird things going on that would give value to watching this whole thing.
There does seem to be an invisible hand at work.
There's a mystical element.
Like when she tries to leave, she just dies very, like it's like she's a balloon that is trying to escape through a forest of needles. I mean, she can't make it more than 7 steps away from the party without a comically
finding a way to die.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But that's why I love the genre, is because on some level, you have to either answer, you have to answer why this is happening, right? And it can be something very soft, like Groundhog Day being the originator is great, because like, it's not like he kicks a gypsy in the first 2 minutes. Sorry, that's a slur. It's not like he kicks a Roma in the first 2 minutes and then a curse is put on him and then he has to break it or he has to find a certain thing. It's like, okay, he needs to be a better person, but then it just resolves, which is awesome that's where the starting point is, that it's like, okay, well, you can make it more of an explanation. You can make it time-altering aliens like they do in Day After Tomorrow. Like
Edge of Tomorrow,
Edge of Tomorrow, yeah.
Edge of Tomorrow, sorry. There's so many different ways that you can go about it. You can do it comedically, you can do it dramatically, you can lean way more into the genre element of it. Yeah. But I think it's super fun when people try to take their spin on it, because it is such a great, unique storytelling trope.
So I found a list of films featuring time loops. There's an anime which talks about sort of like students having to do this. But 3 years before Groundhog Day was the movie 1201, starring Jonathan Silverman, Helen Slater, Jeremy Piven, and Martin Landau, about an office worker that keeps repeating the same day.
That's interesting.
Crazy. Ah.
And that was based on a short story from 1973 by Richard Lupoff. Wow. So you know, certainly is a genre that's been around. There's another story. There's a kind of a neat science fiction book, which has sort of been popular to a lot of people. And that's Replay by Ken Grimwood, which was sort of a, you know, about a guy goes wakes up like every day, like back as a every time he dies, he wakes up back as a teenager and has to relive his life and through. And at one point he like, you know, partners up with a woman and they like hire George Lucas and Spielberg to make movies before they come out, which actually I read another book that came out that has a very similar storyline as that, because people are like, oh, check out this book. I'm like, yeah, that was also like a plot line in Replay. And if you read How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, you'd be like, man, try to repeat that success may not work. You need Brian De Palma there.
You're hiring the wrong Lucas if you're hiring George.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a couple of them to bring in. Yeah. So anyhow, yeah. Cool. Let us know how it ends. I wait to find out from you.
Yeah.
I have a pick, and it's not like you're going to go, oh, Andrew, this is the greatest movie. You'd be like, this is kind of boring, kind of slow, not a lot happens. And I'm like,
you're doing a great sales pitch.
Well, this is all true. The reason I recommend this is because I've talked about this before. One of the things that's interesting about the movie War of the Worlds is that War of the Worlds was one of the greatest science fiction books ever written. Okay, the book is great. The book is just... it became a template for every science fiction invasion story since then. But it was part of a genre. It kind of feels like it came out of nowhere, War of the Worlds, the book. It feels like it came out of nowhere. But actually, there was an entire genre of fiction in British literature that was the invasion sort of story. And generally, it was about the Germans invading. And if you read War of the Worlds and look at that, where they talk about, like, the Martians having their encampments in certain places in Britain, the battle at sea and all this, you go, oh, yeah, this is kind of just making the Germans super advanced, you know, in a way. But it sort of describes sort of land battles and sea battles, whatever, the way that would have played out. So that being a genre, there's other stories in that genre. And there was a book that I never read, but I just saw the movie, which is to get to my pick. It's called The Riddle in the Sands. And it stars Michael York and Simon McCorkindale, a manimal. And basically, there are a couple guys yachting. One guy's yachting in 1901 in the Frisian Islands, which is north of Germany at this point. And he comes across some British people yachting. And it's a little bit suspicious. And basically, the revelation is that it's Germans are plotting to invade England using the Frisian Islands as a base. And he comes up, basically, they uncover this sort of plot. And it's not – I'm like, well, this is very interesting. And it turns out that like in 1898 or 1896, the Kaiser had actually put together plans for an invasion of Britain.
Wow. Oh, wow.
And that was a thing that they were like, hey, yeah, we're kind of afraid that we're no longer at war with France. Maybe Britain's – Germany's going to try to invade at some point. And like, and the Germans pulled back when they realized, nah, it wasn't going to be feasible, whatever. But – and I'm like, well, that's a very interesting point in history when that was – their paranoia was the Germans. And good thing it didn't turn out to be anything.
Oh, yeah, I was about to say. Out, yeah.
The century of peace. A century of peace.
Here.
Yeah. So, but anyhow, the movie, The Riddle in the Sands is kind of it's on Amazon Prime if you want to watch it. Again, it's just, you know, a different, you know, story. So, cool. The Riddle of the Sands. So, anyhow, that's it. It's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.